to Hub History, the show that brings you fascinating stories from Boston history. We're back with episode 32, The Gruesome Tale of the Giggler. Hi, I'm Jake.
And I'm Nikki. This week, we're going to talk about Boston's lesser-known serial killer. Everyone knows the story of the Boston Strangler, who killed 13 women in the Boston area between 1962 and 1964. Fewer people know the tale of the Giggler, who confessed to 4 killings between 1967 and 1969. The victims fit no pattern. They were a young boy and girl, a grown man, and an older woman. The Giggler would simply feel what he described as an irresistible urge to kill. But before we talk about the Giggler, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is June 12th, and on June 12th, 1758, Brigadier James Wolfe led a combined force of Massachusetts militia and British regulars ashore near the fortress of Louisbourg on Cape Breton Island. Louisbourg was a major center of French power in eastern Canada, and the French had spent decades fortifying it. Its strategic location meant that its ships could dominate the St. Lawrence River, gateway to Canada, as well as sending privateers down the New England coast to harass British shipping. Britain and France were locked in a power struggle over control of the continent, resulting in a series of 4 wars fought in North America between 1688 and 1763. It wasn't the first time that British and Americans had targeted Louisbourg. During King George's War, a force assembled by Massachusetts Governor William Shirley had besieged the fortress and eventually captured it in June of 1745. However, during the negotiations that ended the broader War of the Austrian Succession, the fortress was given back to France. During the French and Indian War, the British began a second siege of Louisbourg. The 1,220 hand-picked men under General Wolfe took control of a position known as Lighthouse Point, gaining a foothold that would eventually allow the combined British and American forces to surround the fortress. The French would lay down their arms in July. This time, there would be no backsies. The victorious British leveled the fort with explosives. Then the Treaty of Paris that ended the war gave all of Canada to the English anyway.
Speaking of British troops blowing things up at the end of a siege, something similar happened on Boston Harbor on June 13, 1776. Though the British had evacuated the town of Boston back in March, their ships lingered in the harbor throughout the spring. Finally in June, the surrounding Patriots managed to get cannons onto Long Island and Nantasket. The fleet was now under their guns, and they made preparations to leave. The lighthouse on Little Brewster Island was a strategic asset for the port town of Boston. It had stood since 1716, despite 2 skirmishes the previous summer where the Patriots burned the lighthouse in an attempt to deny it to the British. As the fleet was sailing away, they planted explosive charges in Boston Light. The original lighthouse was completely destroyed. The replacement has been standing on Little Brewster since 1783.
And speaking of Boston serial killers, Wednesday marks the anniversary of the Strangler's first murder. When a middle-aged woman was killed in her apartment on Gainsborough Street on June 14, 1962, the news barely made the front page of the next day's Globe. A small blurb at the bottom of the page announced, "An attractive divorcee was found strangled in her third-floor apartment at 77 Gainsborough Street, Back Bay, at 7:45 last night." Anna Slessers was a 55-year-old Latvian immigrant who worked as a seamstress. She came home at 5:30 p.m., Just over 2 hours later, her son arrived to take her to a special church service. Ms. Slessers was on the kitchen floor in her small apartment. Her bathrobe was ripped open, and the sash was tied tightly around her neck and finished with a neat bow. There would be a dozen more murders over the next 19 months. The women were almost all strangled and almost all sexually assaulted. Eventually, Albert DeSalvo was arrested. Though suspicions swirled around him, he was convicted and imprisoned for another crime. He was never charged as the Strangler. He was himself killed in prison in 1973, and since then many people came to doubt whether he actually committed the Strangler killings. Had the real killer walked free? Finally, in 2013, Albert DeSalvo's body was exhumed, and his DNA was tested against evidence left at the Strangler's final murder scene. The DNA was a match.
Nearly a half century before the famous witch hysteria gripped Salem, a woman named Margaret Jones was sent to the gallows on June 15, 1648, here in Boston. Jones was a midwife and an herbal healer. When bad fortune befell her patients and neighbors, they accused her of witchcraft. Reverend John Hale's book, A Modest Inquiry into the Nature of Witchcraft, records what happened. Several persons have been charged with and suffered for the crime of witchcraft in the governments of the Massachusetts, New Haven, or Stratford in Connecticut from the year 1646 to the year 1692. The first was a woman of Charlestown, around 1647 or 48. She was suspected partly because that after some angry words passing between her and her neighbors, some mischief befell such neighbors in their creatures, or the like. And partly because some things supposed to be bewitched or have a charm upon them, being burned, she came to the fire and seemed concerned. The day of her execution, I went in company of some neighbors, who took great pains to bring her to confession and repentance, but she constantly professed herself innocent of that crime. Then one prayed her to consider if God did not bring this punishment upon her for some other crime, if she had not been guilty of stealing many years ago. She answered, she had stolen something, but it was long since, and she had repented of it, and there was grace enough in Christ to pardon her for that long ago. But as for witchcraft, she was wholly free from it, and so she said unto her death. Her death came on Boston Neck, near today's Washington Street. She was hanged from a tree, becoming the first in a long series of innocent women to die after disputes and resentments with their neighbors turned into accusations of witchcraft.
Friday is June 16th, and on June 16th, 1869, President Ulysses S. Grant attended the premiere of the Great National Peace Jubilee at Boston Coliseum. Advertised as the largest building in the nation, the Coliseum had been built specially for the Peace Jubilee. The Jubilee itself was meant as a grand musical celebration of the country's reunification at the end of the Civil War. It was the brainchild of composer and impresario Patrick Gilmore, an Irish immigrant who was famous for writing When Johnny Comes Marching Home Again while serving as a Union Army band leader during the occupation of New Orleans.
When Johnny comes marching home again, hurrah, hurrah, we'll give him a hearty welcome then, hurrah, hurrah. Oh, the men will cheer, the boys will shout, the ladies, they will all turn out and we'll all feel gay when Johnny comes marching home, and we'll all feel gay.
After the Civil War, the American people seemed ready for grand spectacles, and Gilmore was ready to provide them. He got enough funding from investors to construct a building that was at least the largest performance hall in the country, and possibly the largest building. It was constructed to accommodate an audience of 50,000 curious spectators. They would gather to hear a 1,000-piece orchestra accompany a 10,000-voice chorus. Percussion during dramatic passages would include a battery of cannons, and a band of 100 Boston firemen beating hammer to anvil. The performance opened with a peace hymn, featuring lyrics written by Bostonian Oliver Wendell Holmes. There were locally written favorites like My Country Tis of Thee, as well as international classics like Verdi's Il Trovatore and the William Tell Overture. However, when he was asked what his favorite part of the show was, President Grant replied, "The cannons."
After the Revolutionary War opened with the battles at Concord and Lexington, the Patriots surrounded the fortified city of Boston while the British holed up inside and were supplied by the sea. There was an uneasy quiet for the next couple of months until the Americans decided to push a strong point on Breed's Hill, near Bunker's Hill in Charlestown. The high ground commanded the mouth of the Charles River, and the British were forced to drive them back on June 17, 1775.
Before attacking, the British ate a picnic lunch at the base of the hill. The officers spread a fine silk tablecloth on the ground and dined elegantly on roast duck and claret. The men ate on the barges. Then they formed their battle lines. At the top, the ragged patriots waited in tense silence. Suddenly, the British drums rolled, and the neat columns marched straight up the hill.
Hold your fire, kid. Hold your fire.
Don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes.
Up the hill marched the British, led by General Howe and Major Pitcairn. Closer and closer they came. When the British were only 10 paces away, the Patriots fired. The red column sagged, fell, and broke wildly down the hill. The jubilant Patriots reloaded their rifles.
We did it! We did it!
Easy, easy, kid. Load up again. We ain't licked them yet.
A second time, the British marched up the hill. Again, the Patriot fire pulled them back.
Jenny, we've done it! We've won!
Kid, I'm out of ammo. How about yourself?
I'm out, too.
I was afraid of that.
What do we do?
If the British break through, walk backwards and stay out of reach of their bayonets.
Once again, the British regrouped behind Howe and Pitcairn and marched up the hill. The Patriots opened fire, but quickly ran out of ammunition, and the British strode into the ditches, muskets blazing and bayonets thrusting. Hundreds of Americans like Amos Farnsworth were driven from Bunker Hill that day. 140 were killed. Among the dead was Dr. Joseph Warren. His loss was a tragic blow to the Patriot cause. But the memory of their beloved leader in lace was to stay by many soldiers through the years of war ahead.
The British took the hill, but it would be a Pyrrhic victory. There were over 1,000 British casualties, at the cost of just over 100 Americans killed. Patriot General Nathanael Greene would say, "I wish we could sell them another hill at the same cost." Across the harbor in Braintree, future President John Quincy Adams watched the battle with his mother. In her first letter to John Sr. after receiving the news of the battle and Warren's loss, Abigail Adams said, "The day, perhaps the decisive day, is come on which the fate of America depends. My bursting heart must find vent at my pen. I have just heard that our dear friend Dr. Warren is no more, but fell gloriously fighting for his country, saying, 'Better to die honorably in the field than ignominiously hang upon the gallows.' Great is our loss. He has distinguished himself in every engagement by his courage and fortitude, by animating the soldiers, and leading them on by his own example." The British would hold the hill until their evacuation the following March, but they would take no more ground back from the Patriots.
Finally, Sunday is June 18th. On June 18th, 1681, the Royal Charter for Massachusetts Bay Colony was canceled by a judgment of the High Court of Chancery. The justifications given publicly included everything from running an illegal mint to the colony's pattern of discrimination against Quakers. After the English Civil War, Puritan Massachusetts enjoyed the favor of a series of Puritan governments ruling in Great Britain during the interregnum. However, after Charles II was restored to the throne in 1660, their relationship with the mother country went downhill fast. Vacating the colonial charter allowed the new king to end the colony's long tradition of self-government. The new colonial governor would be appointed by the king and would be beholden only to him. Towns lost their right to govern by town meeting, and the colonies from Maine to Pennsylvania were joined together into a single Dominion of New England. It goes without saying that these were not popular changes in Massachusetts. To hear just how unhappy the colonists were, and what would happen when they took matters into their own hands after the Glorious Revolution, you can check out Episode 6, which is called The First Boston Revolution.
This week's story also opens with a grim anniversary. Friday marks the anniversary of a 911 call recorded in the wee hours of June 16th, 1969, that is still chilling to hear.
"I'm here at the corner of Washington and Newland Street in a construction site. There'll be a man down in the water. Dead. The giggler."
It's a little bit muffled, but the 911 operator says, "Boston Police." Then the caller says, "My dear, at the corner of Washington and Nealon Street, in a construction site, there'll be a man down in the water, dead." The giggler, and then he starts laughing. Police went to the construction site, and they found the body of a man named Joe Breen. At the time, Washington and Nealon was near the heart of Boston's combat zone, an unofficial district in which strip clubs and porno theaters were tolerated and prostitution was common. Perhaps the setting convinced the Globe to publish an article by Jeremiah Murphy about Joe Breen's murder that reads like a hard-boiled detective novel.
The last time Joe Breen was seen alive was in the Novelty Bar, a rundown joint in the neon-lighted combat zone where some people drink beer directly out of the bottle because they have a hunch it's safer that way. Breen walked in the front door on Washington Street. A long raised bar was on the left, and a cigarette machine and shuffleboard game was on the right. Illuminated signs advertising Schlitz beer were on the walls. A three-piece band was playing in the back. It was dimly lit inside the Novelty Bar, and people talked easily in obscenities, and nobody really paid any attention. It's that type of joint. There were the inevitable three or four young sailors sitting around, and eight or nine women, mostly in their 30s, and a few of them were pretty. They chain-smoked, and their eyes kept moving, always watching whoever came through the door. Breen was 31 years old, single, and a four-year Marine Corps veteran. He lived on Robert Street in Brookline, and worked for the water department there. He had a few drinks at the bar with the two fellows who were with him, then he started playing shuffleboard. His opponent, whom he had never met before, was in his early 30s, average height, and pudgy, wearing old clothes. Breen's two friends went across the street to another bar, and he stayed in the Novelty and played shuffleboard with his pudgy new friend. After a while, the combat zone bars closed, and Breen's friends returned to the Novelty to meet him. He was gone, and they never saw him alive again. The friends shrugged, figuring Joe Breen had gone along home, and they went home too. But at 1:30 a.m., a telephone call was received at Boston Police Headquarters on Berkeley Street. Bill Barnes of Brookline was with Breen that night in the Novelty, and he gave police a description of the shuffleboard player. For a long time, Barnes and a plainclothes policeman waited, night after night, in the Novelty, but the man never showed. The police officer was assigned to other duties, but Barnes kept going back, sitting alone at the bar, the rock band banging away in the background, the women in the booth still looking, still smoking, and Barnes waited and waited. One night, the shuffleboard player came in, and Barnes knew it was him. He quietly got up and walked to a telephone, and he called the police. They came right away, but it was too late. The shuffleboard player had gone. Again. The mystery would go unsolved for 6 months, while the murderer walked the streets.
On December 26th, a 9-year-old boy named Kenneth Martin went missing in Boston. The third grader from St. Ambrose School was last seen near South Station, where he worked as a pin setter at the station's bowling alley. Police had no leads in locating him until January 6, 1970, when they got an anonymous call saying that the body could be located in a passageway under South Station. At the time, there was a labyrinth of tunnels and corridors under the station, as well as a number of businesses and offices. The police eventually found Martin's body on January 8th. It was in an unused tunnel under the station. He had been strangled with a piece of twine that had been wrapped around his neck several times and tied tightly. Then his body was left in a canvas sack. There was no evidence of sexual assault. Witnesses remembered seeing the boy in the company of a dark-haired, chubby young man. The descriptions matched a drifter named Kenneth Harrison. Harrison was 31 years old, an unemployed cook and cab driver who often slept in one of the unused offices along the corridors under South Station. Harrison had jumped a train to Providence, but four Boston detectives went south and had the good fortune to spot him standing on a street corner near the train station. They arrested him and brought him back to Boston for interrogation. He quickly admitted to Kenneth Martin's murder, saying that they had both been killing time in the South Station tunnels, chatting in an unused office. Harrison said that he had been drunk out of his skull when he suddenly felt an irresistible urge to kill. He said he had felt bad after waking up beside the body, but coldly waited over a week before calling in the location to the police and leaving town.
But what he said next stopped the detectives in their tracks. "As long as I'm here, I might as well tell you about a few more. That overpowering urge to kill had taken hold of Harrison before. His killing spree began in May of 1967, just 3 years after the Strangler's grip on the city had loosened. The first victim of the Giggler was 6-year-old Lucy Palmerin. She was on her way to a candy shop to get a treat when she had the misfortune of getting into a cab driven by Kenneth Harrison. Somewhere during the ride, the urge to kill struck Harrison. He pulled the cab to the side of the street on a bridge over Fort Point Channel and enticed Lucy out of the car with the offer of a piggyback ride. Instead of boosting her up onto his shoulders, he pivoted and threw her into the water below. Somehow nobody saw him do it, so when her body washed ashore 5 weeks later, her death was ruled a tragic accident. Fort Point Channel must have held some sort of fascination for Harrison, because it was the site of one of his other murders as well. In November of 1969, just a month before Kenneth Martin's death, Harrison was walking across Broadway Bridge over the channel. When he saw an elderly woman slip and fall on the ice, he helped her up and offered his arm as assistance in crossing the bridge. Unfortunately for 75-year-old Clover Parker, that urge to kill swept over him again as they were crossing. Harrison punched her up, as he said in his confession, took her cane away, and then pitched the petite woman over the rail and into the water below. Again, there were no witnesses, and again, the case was ruled an accident. But Harrison wasn't done confessing yet. He also admitted to killing Joe Breen in that construction site in the combat zone. He confirmed that he and Breen had spent many hours together that night drinking and playing shuffleboard, but when the time came to part, the two argued over who would pay for whiskey and cab fare. They fought, and Harrison pushed Breen into a water-filled trench among the construction site. As an ex-Marine, Breen was able to put up more of a fight than the small children and old ladies Harrison usually preyed on, but Harrison was able to get the upper hand. Every time Breen came up for air in the muck-filled trench, Harrison would bash him in the head with a large rock, until Breen eventually stopped coming up. He died in the water, his skull bashed in. That's when Harrison made his call to the police, reporting the body, and claiming his comic book villain-like name, the Giggler. The detectives had him record portions of what was said in that call so they could match it against the original recording.
Yeah, this is Sergeant Whalen, and Kenneth Harrison is now going to read from a piece of paper, a statement, onto this tape. The date is January the 7th, 1970, and the time is 3:55 p.m.
All right. I'll just hold that in front of my dear, there'll be a man down in the water, dead, at the construction site, the corner of Neyland and Washington Street. Ha 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 ha, the Giggler.
Believe it or not, Harrison still had more to say. He tried to claim credit for the January 1966 fire that destroyed the Paramount Hotel in the combat zone and killed 11 people, saying he did it for giggles. For whatever reason, he was never charged with this crime, though it would have brought his death toll to 15. Perhaps they didn't believe him, or perhaps they thought the evidence was insufficient. In each of the other murders, Harrison's confession contained details that were never made public, and his statements on the Paramount fire were certainly less clear-cut. In the end, Kenneth Harrison was convicted of first-degree murder in the killing of Kenneth Martin and given a life sentence without the possibility of parole. He received 3 additional life sentences for the second-degree murders of his other victims, with the sentences to run concurrently. He was remanded to the Bridgewater State Mental Hospital for evaluation and treatment, where he remained for almost 20 years. In April of 1989, the state ruled that the combination of therapies he had received at Bridgewater had made him rational enough to serve out the balance of his sentence at Concord State Prison. On the eve of the transfer, the man who dubbed himself the Giggler took a lethal dose of his antidepressant Elavil and died on April 20th, 1989.
To learn more about the gruesome tale of the Giggler, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/032. We'll have pictures of Kenneth Harrison and 2 of his victims, as well as a link to that recording of his 911 call and tape made during his interrogation. We'll link to that great noir story about Joe Breen from the Boston Globe, and a story about the Paramount Hotel fire. And of course, we'll have links and sources for all of this week's historical anniversaries.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're at Hub History on Twitter and at facebook.com/hubhistory. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. And if you subscribe on iTunes, we'd love it if you could write us a brief review. It is the best way to help other people find the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time with a show about the four burials of Joseph Warren.
That's Dr. Joseph Warren.
I'm leaving that in.